38% of homes bought, according to the National Association of Realtors. They became a force in the market, driving up turnover of existing homes by almost one-third. By then, the TV news was carrying reports of flippers, speculators in places like Las Vegas and Miami. They would use easy credit to load up on 5 or 6 new condos, aiming to sell them at a large profit even before the apartments were built. Such dramas remained strictly regional, however. I would tell audiences that we were facing not a bubble, but a froth. Lots of small, local bubbles that never grew to a scale that could threaten the health of the overall economy. Whether a bubble or a froth, the party was winding down by late 2005, when first-time buyers began to find prices increasingly out of reach. Higher prices required larger mortgages, which began to claim a burdensome share of monthly income. The heady days when buyers paid above offering prices to bid away a house were over. Sellers' offering prices held up, but buyers pulled their bids. Sales volumes accordingly fell sharply for both new and existing homes. The boom was over. It had been part of a historic international trend. Mortgage interest rates had fallen not just in the United States, but also in Great Britain, Australia, and many other countries that have viable mortgage markets. In response, home prices worldwide had soared. The Economist, which tracks home prices in 20 countries, has estimated that between 2000 and 2005, the market value of residential property in developed nations rose from $40 trillion to more than $70 trillion. The largest share of that increase, $8 trillion, occurred in U.S. single-family homes. But the experience of other economies was suggestive because their booms began and ended a year or two ahead of ours. In Australia and Britain, demand began to cool in 2004 for the same reasons it later cooled in the United States. First-time buyers got priced out of the market, and speculative investors drew back. Importantly, as the boom ended in those countries, prices leveled out or declined slightly, but at this writing have not crashed. Because of the housing boom and the accompanying explosion in new mortgage products, the typical American household ended up with a more valuable home and better access to the wealth it represented. Its mortgage is bigger too, of course, but since the debt carries a lower interest rate, the drain on income from debt service as a share of homeowner income did not change much between 2000 and 2005. The post-9/11 recovery had a dark side, however. It was marred by a disturbing shift in the concentration of income. For the past 4 years, gains in the average hourly salaries of supervisory workers have significantly outstripped gains in the average hourly earnings of production and non-supervisory workers. For many households, the lag in real incomes was offset by capital gains on their homes, even though the bulk of the capital gains went to households in the upper middle and upper income groups. You could see the income divergence reflected in the polls, even as economic growth returned. By 2004, real GDP was expanding at a healthy 3.9% a year, unemployment declined, and aggregate wages and salaries weren't doing all that badly either. Yet most of the rise in average incomes was owing to disproportionate gains among the highly skilled. There are a lot more workers who earn at the median income, and they have not been doing all that well. Thus, it is no surprise that researchers who telephoned 1,000 households found that 60% thought the economy was awful, while only 40% thought it was just fine. Two-tier economies are common in developing countries, but not since the 1920s have Americans experienced such inequality of income. It used to be that when the aggregate numbers were good, the polls would be positive as well. More recently, the unwinding of the housing boom has hurt some groups. It did not create great difficulties for the great mass of homeowners who had built up substantial equity in their houses as prices rose. But many low-income families who took advantage of subprime mortgage offerings to become first-time homeowners joined the boom too late to enjoy its benefits. Without an equity buffer to fall back on, they are having difficulty making their monthly payments, and increasing numbers are facing foreclosure. Of the nearly $3 trillion of home mortgage originations in 2006, a fifth were subprime, and another fifth were so-called Alt-A mortgages. The latter are mortgages taken out by people with good credit histories, but whose monthly payments are often interest-only, and whose documentation with respect to the borrower's income and other characteristics is inadequate. Poor performance of this two-fifths of originations has induced a significant tightening of credit availability, with a noticeable impact on home sales. I was aware that the loosening of mortgage credit terms for subprime borrowers increased financial risk and that subsidized homeownership initiatives distort market outcomes. But I believe then, as now, that the benefits of broadened homeownership are worth the risk. Protection of property rights, so critical to a market economy, requires a critical mass of owners to sustain political support. As much as the economy's overall resilience heartened me, I was distressed by the performance of the government. Red ink flooded back in 2002. We ran a deficit of $158 billion, a deterioration of more than $250 billion from the $127 billion surplus of 2001. President Bush continued to direct his administration toward fulfilling the promises he had made during the 2000 presidential campaign, cutting taxes, strengthening national defense, and adding prescription drug benefits to Medicare. These goals had not been unrealistic in the light of large and projected surpluses. But the surpluses were gone 6 to 9 months after George W. Bush took office, and in the revised world of growing deficits, the goals were no longer entirely appropriate. He continued to pursue his presidential campaign promises nonetheless. Most troubling to me was the readiness of both Congress and the administration to abandon fiscal discipline. 4 years of surplus had made thrift an increasingly scarce commodity on Capitol Hill. Surpluses are irresistible to officials who thrive on the political free lunch. I cannot count how many letters I received from Capitol Hill in the 1990s outlining one scheme or another to spend more or tax less, with the pay-go requirement satisfied by some sleight-of-hand financing obscurity, the purpose of which was to hide the cost of the scheme. In the Congress, double-entry bookkeeping had become a lost art. It finally dropped the pretense. During the final year of the Clinton administration, Congress had ignored its self-imposed discretionary spending caps to legislate an estimated $1 trillion of additional spending over 10 years. Without this spending, the record $237 billion surplus in 2000 would have been even larger. Then, with George Bush, came the tax cuts, unmatched by decreased spending, and in the wake of September 11th, still more open-handed spending. Laws passed after 9/11 included needed increases for defense and homeland security, of course. But our national emergency fiscal measures also seemed to whet Congress's appetite for pork spending programs for constituents. An early example was a $60 billion transportation bill that passed almost unanimously in December 2001. It allocated large sums to expand airline security and imposed a tax on plane tickets to partly offset the cost, sensible moves, arguably. Yet it also included more than $400 million of pure pork, highway funding taken out of the state's control and earmarked by legislators for pet road projects back home. I was even more offended by the farm bill the following May. It was a budget-busting, six-year, $250 billion handout that reversed hard-fought earlier initiatives to scale back agricultural subsidies and open up farm trade to market forces. The new package greatly increased subsidies on cotton and grain and heaped new subsidies on everything from sugar to chickpeas. The chairman of the House Agriculture Committee, Texas Republican Larry Combest, pushed for the bill, as did Midwestern Democrats, like Senate Leader Daschle of South Dakota. There is a remedy for legislative excess. It's called a presidential veto. In conversations behind the scenes with senior economic officials, I made no secret of my view that President Bush ought to reject a few bills. It would send a message to Congress that it did not have carte blanche on spending. But the answer I received from a senior White House official was that the president didn't want to challenge House Speaker Dennis Hastert. He thinks he can control him better by not antagonizing him, the official said. And indeed, not exercising veto power became a hallmark of the Bush presidency. For nearly 6 years in the White House, he did not throw out a single bill. This was without modern historical precedent. Johnson, Nixon, Carter, Reagan, George H.W. Bush, Clinton, all had vetoed dozens of bills. And Gerry Ford had vetoed everything in sight, more than 60 bills in less than 3 years. This enabled him, even though faced with large Democratic majorities in both houses of Congress, to assert a great deal of power and steer the lawmakers in directions he thought important. To my mind, Bush's collaborate, don't confront approach was a major mistake. it cost the nation a check-and-balance mechanism essential to fiscal discipline. Budget discipline in Washington formally gave up the ghost on September 30, 2002. That was the day Congress allowed America's primary anti-deficit law to expire. The Budget Enforcement Act of 1990 had been a monument to congressional self-restraint. Enacted with bipartisan support under the first President Bush, the law had played an important role in bringing the federal deficit under control, thereby helping to set the stage for the 1990s boom. In it, Congress imposed on itself strict discretionary caps and pay-go rules that required new spending increases or tax cuts to be offset elsewhere in the budget. Violating these provisions would automatically trigger heavy penalties, such as across-the-board reductions in social programs and defense, cuts any politician would take pains to avoid. But the Budget Enforcement Act never envisioned years of surplus. Ironically, its goal had been to achieve a balanced budget by 2002. And in the late 1990s rush to spend, Congress seized on technicalities to flout its rules. As a longtime House staffer put it, "We were required to be deficit neutral, but there were no deficits." Yet now, with the safeguards due to expire, deficits were flooding back. In mid-September, I made the most strenuous plea I could for Congress to retain this first line of defense. "The budget enforcement rules are set to expire," I told the House Budget Committee. "Failing to preserve them would be a grave mistake. For without clear direction and constructive goals, the inbuilt political bias in favor of budget deficits likely will again become entrenched. If we do not preserve the budget rules and reaffirm our commitment to fiscal responsibility, years of hard effort will be squandered." The worst consequences would not be immediate, I acknowledged, but they would be severe. I warned, "History suggests that an abandonment of fiscal discipline will eventually push up interest rates, crowd out capital spending, lower productivity growth, and force harder choices upon us in the future." My statement had circulated in advance. It was obviously not a message the committee members wanted to hear. Of the 41 members of the committee, only about half showed up. I watched the congresspeople's reactions as I read a passage invoking the historic bipartisan consensus that had given birth to the Budget Enforcement Act. Mostly I was met with blank stares. Worse, the question and answer session made it plain that few, if any, of the legislators had any interest in perpetuating spending constraints. Instead of addressing my proposal and the larger economic danger to which it pointed, the questioners simply changed the subject. The discussion focused almost entirely on tax cuts, present and future, pro and con. And that was what dominated the sparse news reports of my testimony the following day. In the Senate, Pete Domenici, Phil Gramm, Kent Conrad, Don Nichols, and other fiscal conservatives worked to retain the budget balancing mechanisms. But the political will wasn't there. All they managed was to put through a 6-month extension of a procedural rule that made it slightly harder to pass legislation increasing the deficit. But without the Budget Enforcement Act's mandatory penalties, the rule had no teeth. The budget discipline that had served us so well was effectively dead. After the Republicans scored a sweeping victory in the November 2002 midterm elections, the situation got worse. Glenn Hubbard, the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers, argued in a December speech that it made little difference to the overall economy whether the budget was balanced or not. "One can hope that the discussion will move away from the idea that higher deficits would push up long-term interest rates and chill growth," he said. "That's Rubenomics, and we think it's completely wrong." Leaving aside this jibe at the Democrats, what Hubbard said was accurate in a short-term context. Securities markets have become so efficient that current interest rates move only when new information brings changes in expectations of future budget deficits and Treasury debt. Incremental, immediate changes in the supply of U.S. Treasury obligations are generally quite small relative to the global supply of comparably safe long-term debt instruments. Small changes in relative prices, that is, interest rates, can induce investors to replace considerable quantities of Treasury debt with equal amounts of high-quality corporate debt or foreign government obligations. The converse is also true. Such changes in debt, or, by extension, deficits, are associated with surprisingly small changes in interest rates. The size and efficiency of the global market for bonds competitive with U.S. Treasuries obscure the underlying long-term relationship between federal deficits, debt, and interest rates. Sometimes, when an issue is complex, it is a useful exercise to take it to an extreme. If it were true that deficits did not matter and tax cuts unmatched by spending cuts were good public policy, then why not just eliminate all taxes? Congress could borrow as much as it wanted and spend as freely as it liked, all without fear that the government's rapidly accumulating ocean of debt would erode economic growth. Yet, as we have seen time after time in developing countries, unbridled government borrowing and spending produce hyperinflation and economic devastation. So deficits must matter. The crucial question for policymakers is not, do they hurt growth, but how much do they hurt growth? In fact, Hubbard, whose econometric models show only a small impact on interest rates from changes in Treasury debt outstanding, nonetheless recently wrote, "Our findings should not be construed as implying that deficits don't matter. Substantially larger, persistent, and unsustainable levels of government debt can eventually put increasing strains on the available domestic and foreign sources of loanable funds. In the United States at the present time, unfunded implicit obligations associated with the Social Security and Medicare programs are particularly of concern." But the subtleties of the economic debate got lost in the political realities. Congress and the President viewed budgetary restraint as inhibiting the legislation they wanted. "Deficits don't matter," to my chagrin, became part of Republicans' rhetoric. It was a struggle for me to accept that this had become the dominant ethos and economic policy of the Republican Party. But I'd had a preview of it many years before, in the 1970s, over lunch with Jack Kemp, then a young congressman from upstate New York. He complained that Democrats were always buying votes by boosting spending all over the place, and eventually the resulting deficits would land in the lap of a Republican administration to solve. "Why can't we be a little irresponsible ourselves?" he asked, startling me. "Why can't we cut taxes and give away the goodies before they can?" And indeed, that's what was happening now. My sensibilities as a libertarian Republican were offended. In late December 2002 and early January, I took the unusual step of pushing senior economic officials in the White House to adopt a more rational approach. I can't say my protests had much substantive effect, but the White House must have realized that "deficits don't matter" sounded extreme, because it adjusted its language by the time President Bush presented his 2004 budget plan. "My administration firmly believes in controlling the deficit and reducing it as the economy strengthens and our national security interests are met," he declared to Congress on February 3, 2003. He went on to argue that deficits for the moment were inevitable because of the need for new tax cuts to stimulate growth and the need for new spending to fund the war against terror. The next day, John Snow, who had recently succeeded Paul O'Neill as Treasury chief, struck a similar note. "Deficits matter," he told the House Ways and Means Committee, "but the ones projected in the president's new budget were both manageable and unavoidable." The new budget to me was a little more discouraging. Outlays totaled more than $2.2 trillion, and the bottom line was a projected deficit of more than $300 billion in both 2003 and 2004, and another $200 billion, using rather rosy assumptions, I thought, in 2005. The proposal, predictably, provided for substantial spending jumps for Homeland Security and defense. Yet it did not include funding for the looming war in Iraq. If that occurred, the administration would have to seek a special appropriation, which would push the deficit still higher. The budget's centerpiece was a second major round of tax cuts, which President Bush had initially proposed a few weeks before. Of these, the most costly was the partial elimination of the double taxation of dividends. For years, I have advocated the full elimination of the double taxation of corporate dividends as an incentive to capital investment. The new plan also accelerated Bush's across-the-board income tax reductions so that they would take effect right away and made permanent the repeal of the estate tax. Bottom line, the tax package was projected to add $670 billion, or more than $1 trillion if the cuts were made permanent, over 10 years to the $1.35 trillion cost of Bush's first round of tax relief. Mitch Daniels, the director of the Office of Management and Budget, was quick to point out that a $300 billion budget deficit was the equivalent of only 2.7% of GDP, relatively modest by historical standards. True, But my main concern was the failure to address the longer-term path of promised benefits that are going to leave a very large hole in future budgets. We should be preparing ourselves for the retirement of the baby boomers with balanced budgets or surpluses for the difficult years ahead. Surpluses no longer pose the threat of an accumulation of private assets that they did in 2001. The level of debt is now substantially higher than contemplated in 2001. There was talk that additional tax cuts would revitalize economic growth. But in the Fed's analysis, the lingering lethargy reflected anxiety and uncertainty about war, not a need for more stimulus. Iraq dominated the news. On February 5th, Colin Powell had given his United Nations speech accusing Iraq of hiding weapons of mass destruction. 10 days later, there were anti-war marches in cities around the world. Until the situation in Iraq was resolved, there was no way to know whether more tax cuts made sense. I told the Senate Banking Committee on February 11th, I am one of the few people who still are not as yet convinced that stimulus is a desirable policy at this particular point. Far more urgent than tax cuts, I said, was the need to address the threat posed by the soaring new deficits. Bring back statutory spending caps and pay-go rules, I urged the senators. I am concerned that, should the enforcement mechanism governing the budget process not be restored, the resulting lack of clear direction and constructive goals would allow budget deficits to again become entrenched. That, in turn, would beget problems no amount of stimulus would solve. The supply-side argument that faster economic growth would make deficits easier to contain was doubtless true, I said, except in the unlikely event that a tax cut is wholly saved, the part that is spent raises GDP and the tax base and hence tax receipts. Thus, the gross tax cut is larger than the loss in receipts. But there is still a loss. Given the size of the shortfalls we faced, I warned, economic growth cannot be safely counted upon to eliminate deficits and the difficult choices that will be required to restore fiscal discipline. The fact that I was openly challenging the administration's plan caused a stir. No, Mr. President, Greenspan delivers a stern rebuke on rising deficits, was a headline the next morning in the Financial Times. But the headlines in U.S. papers showed that I had failed to shift the debate to where it belonged. I was trying to get people to see the need for fiscal restraint, encompassing not just taxes, but more important, spending. Yet all anyone focused on was taxes. The Washington Post wrote, Greenspan says tax cuts are premature, war fears blamed for stagnation. Greenspan advises putting tax cuts on hold, said USA Today. Nor did anyone in the congressional leadership take up the cause of budgetary controls. The tax cuts issue briefly became a media circus. That week, more than 450 economists, including 10 Nobel laureates, published a letter arguing that the tax cuts proposed by Bush would drive up the deficits without much helping the economy. The White House countered with a letter, signed by 250 economists, supporting its plan. I knew many of the names. The 450 were mainly Keynesians, and the 250 were mainly supply-siders. The entire debate shed less light than heat and was quickly eclipsed by the war in Iraq. By May, when Congress gave the president the tax cut he wanted and he signed it into law, the need for budgetary discipline was nowhere on the priority list. I knew how Cassandra must have felt. During the Bush administration, particularly after 9/11, I spent more time at the White House than ever before in my Fed career. At least once a week, I'd make the short walk from my office to the elevator that took me to the Fed garage for the half-mile drive to the Southwest Gate. These trips sometimes involved routine meetings with National Economic Council Chief Steve Friedman, his successor Al Hubbard, or other senior economic officials. Periodically, I would visit with Dick Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, Andy Card, or any of a number of other officials. And sometimes, of course, I'd be there to see the president. I was back to being a consultant. The agendas of these meetings covered international economics, the global dynamics of energy and oil, the future of Social Security, deregulation, accounting fraud, problems with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and, when appropriate, monetary policy. Many of the ideas I worked hardest to convey appear in the chapters that follow. The Bush administration turned out to be very different from the reincarnation of the Ford administration that I had imagined. Now, the political operation was far more dominant. As Fed chairman, I was an independent force, and I'd been around for quite a long while, but I certainly did not qualify as part of the inner circle, nor did I want to be. It quickly became clear that there was no room in the administration for an outspoken deficit hawk like Paul O'Neill. Initiatives he and I spent many hours planning, the transition to Social Security private accounts, for example, and a strict new law to govern CEO accountability, got no better reception than the triggers we'd advocated during the first round of tax cuts. Paul's outspokenness put him at odds with the administration, which emphasized loyalty and staying on message. Paul spent much of his 2 years as Treasury Secretary feuding with the Bush economists, especially Larry Lindsey, the primary architect of the tax cuts. After the 2002 election, the White House obtained both men's resignations. It replaced Paul with another former CEO, John Snow, who had headed the giant railroad company CSX. John proved to be a better administrator than Paul and a smoother, much more effective spokesman for economic policy, which was all that the White House wanted its Treasury Secretary to be. The President and I continued to relate much as we had that first morning at the Madison Hotel. Several times each year, he would invite me to lunch in his private dining room, usually with Vice President Cheney, Andy Card, and one of the economic advisors. In these meetings, as in the first, I would do most of the talking about global economic trends and problems. I talked so much that I don't recall ever having time to eat. I would end up grabbing a bite back at my office. For the 5 years we overlapped, President Bush honored his commitment to the autonomy of the Fed. Of course, during most of that time, we kept short-term interest rates extremely low, so there wasn't much to complain about. Yet even in 2004, after economic growth returned and the FOMC began ratcheting up rates, the White House did not comment. Meanwhile, the President remained tolerant of, if not receptive to, my criticism of his fiscal policy. Barely a month after I countered his argument for the urgency of another tax cut, for instance, he announced he intended to nominate me for a fifth term as chairman. This caught me by surprise. My fourth term wasn't even due to expire for another year. The administration also took the Fed's advice on policies we thought were essential for the health of the financial markets. Most important was the effort that began in 2003 to curb excesses at Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the companies chartered by Congress to help underwrite home mortgages. They are granted a de facto subsidy by financial markets in the form of interest rates with very low credit risk premiums on their debt. The markets presume Uncle Sam will bail them out in the event of default. Fannie and Freddie had been using this subsidy to pad their profits and grow. But their dealings had begun to distort and endanger the markets and seemed likely to become a bigger and bigger problem. The companies employed skillful lobbyists and had powerful advocates in Congress. President Bush had very little to gain politically by supporting a crackdown, yet he backed the Fed through a 2-year struggle that resulted in crucial reforms. My biggest frustration remained the President's unwillingness to wield his veto against out-of-control spending. Not long ago, I had occasion to assess the change in fiscal status of the United States since January 2001, when the administration took office. I compared the budget outlook through September 2006. Under the then-current policy, existing law and budget conventions, as estimated by the Congressional Budget Office, with the actual outcomes through 2006. Debt to the public outstanding projected for the end of September 2006 was $1.2 trillion. The actual outcome was $4.8 trillion. That is a rather large miss. To be sure, a significant part of the shortfall in receipts owed to the CBO's failure to judge adequately the looming shortfall in capital gains and other taxes related to the stock market decline. But by 2002, that was already known to the administration and the Congress, and they altered their policy approach very little. The rest of the shortfall owes to policy, tax cuts, and spending increases. The costs of the Iraq War and anti-terrorism measures do not explain the gap. Appropriations for both totaled $120 billion in fiscal year 2006, the Congressional Budget Office estimated. This is a large sum, but in a $13 trillion economy, it's readily absorbable. Federal outlays on national defense, which in fiscal 2000 hit a 60-year low of 3% of GDP, jumped back to around 4% in 2004 and have since flattened out. They were 4.1% in 2006. By comparison, national defense spending at the height of the Vietnam War absorbed 9.5% of GDP, and during the Korean War, more than 14%. But spending in the civilian sector, so-called non-defense discretionary outlays, has soared past the projections made in the surplus-rich days of the new millennium. Most dispiriting to me was the enactment in late 2003 of the Prescription Drug Act. Instead of incorporating much-needed Medicare reforms, it was estimated to add more than $500 billion over 10 years to the system's vast and intractable costs. While it allowed the president to check off another of his campaign promises, it provided no way to come up with the needed funds. This wasn't an isolated event. As the administration and Congress set a course toward a federal deficit of more than $400 billion in 2004, Republicans actually tried to rationalize the abandonment of the libertarian small government ideal. It turned out the American people did not want a major reduction of government, wrote Congressman John Boehner of Ohio in a position paper just after the drug bill passed. Boehner had been an architect of the Republican takeover of the House 9 years before, but now the party was facing new political realities, he said. Rather than shrinking the size of government, the best that could be hoped for was slowing its growth. Republicans have accepted such realities as the burdens of majority governance, he wrote. Bigger but more efficient government should be the new goal, he and other party leaders argued. They achieved the former, but not the latter. The reality was even uglier. For many party leaders, altering the electoral process to create a permanent Republican-led government became a major goal. House Speaker Hastert and House Majority Leader Tom DeLay seemed readily inclined to loosen the federal purse strings any time it might help add a few more seats to the Republican majority. The Senate leadership proved only somewhat better. Majority Leader Bill Frist, an exceptionally intelligent physician who favored fiscal discipline, lacked the force of personality to do the necessary head-knocking. Conservatives like Phil Gramm, John McCain, Chuck Hagel, and John Sununu usually found their warnings unheard. Congress was too busy feeding at the trough. The abuse of earmarks became extreme, as politicians exercised this power to direct government spending to particular projects, leading to lobbying and corruption scandals in 2005. The Pork Barrel Reduction Act, introduced afterward by a bipartisan group led by McCain, observed that earmarks in congressional appropriations had proliferated from 3,023 in 1996, at the end of Clinton's first term, to nearly 16,000 in 2005, the start of Bush's second. The total dollar amount of the pork was harder to gauge. Some earmarks are legitimate, but by any definition, it was in the tens of billions of dollars. Admittedly, such sums are a very small percentage of the $2 trillion-plus federal budget, but that is not the point. Earmarks are the canaries in the coal mine when it comes to the collapse of fiscal discipline, and the canaries looked sick. After the Republicans lost control of Congress in the November 2006 election, former House Republican Majority Leader Dick Armey published a perceptive op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal. Its headline was, End of the Revolution, and it harked back to the 1994 Republican takeover of Congress. Our primary question in those early years was, how do we reform government and return money and power back to the American people? Eventually, the policy innovators and the spirit of 94 were largely replaced by political bureaucrats driven by a narrow vision. Their question became, how do we hold on to political power? The aberrant behavior and scandals that ended up defining the Republican majority in 2006 were a direct consequence of this shift. Armey had it exactly right. The Republicans in Congress lost their way. They swapped principle for power. They ended up with neither. They deserved to lose. Tears welled in my eyes as I observed the throngs of Americans standing in silent tribute to Gerald R. Ford in the waning days of 2006. They lined the streets as a motorcade delivered the body of the 38th President of the United States from Andrews Air Force Base to the Capitol, where it would lie in state. At 93, he had been our longest living president. It was remarkable to see Washington, D.C., so torn with partisan strife and harboring a dysfunctional government, universally embrace this symbol of bipartisan camaraderie of a distant era. It was a tribute to this genial soul, but also evidence of Americans' thirst for the civility in politics that Ford represented and that had long since departed. Ford was beaten by Jimmy Carter in the presidential election of 1976, And it was symbolic that Carter delivered one of the eulogies as Ford was put to rest in Grand Rapids, Michigan, mourned by the people whom he had represented in the Congress for a quarter century. What cost Ford the 1976 election was the presidential pardon he had granted Richard Nixon. That decision had created a firestorm among the Democrats, who wanted Nixon held accountable for his malfeasance in office. Yet as the years passed, many prominent Democrats came to believe that Ford's pardon had been essential to getting the trauma of Watergate behind us. Senator Ted Kennedy called it an extraordinary act of courage. Senator Kennedy made this statement on May 21, 2001, as Ford was awarded the John F. Kennedy Profile and Courage Award by the Kennedy Library in Boston. As I looked out the window of my car in the procession on that sunny day, only yards from the hearse carrying Ford's casket, I was an honorary pallbearer, I couldn't help but wonder what had happened to American politics since Gerry Ford would battle Tip O'Neill, then Speaker of a Democratic Congress, from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., but still invite his longtime friend for evening cocktails at the White House. I joined the Ford administration in August 1974, with the trauma of Watergate still gripping Washington. Yet partisan fervor was largely set aside as the sun went down. The dinners I attended, a Washington political ritual, were invariably bipartisan. Senators and representatives from both parties would mix with administration stalwarts, the media, and the city's social power brokers. During 2005, my last full year in government, the ritual dinners were still there, but they had become intensely partisan. On many occasions, I was the only Republican present, and at Republican dinners I attended, there were few, if any, Democrats. The annual black tie events, sponsored mainly by the media, the gridiron and other correspondence dinners, were as bipartisan as they'd been in my Ford years, but the camaraderie at those events was forced and synthetic. There is considerable academic analysis, but little agreement about the causes of partisan frictions. There is even an intriguing thesis that the halcyon days of bipartisan camaraderie in the 1950s and 1960s were the historical aberration, and today's frictions are not much out of line with history. From my narrower perch, where I watched Nixon's Southern strategy successfully evolve in his 1968 campaign, it seemed that the roots of our political dysfunction trace back to a shift in Southern conservative congressional representation from Democratic to Republican control following the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Democrats greatly outnumbered Republicans in the 1960s, and for almost all of the years since the New Deal, they had controlled the Congress and the White House. With a lock on the South, Southern Democrats built up important seniority in the Congress and had been dominant as committee chairman since the presidency of Franklin D. Roosevelt. The uneasy coalition of Northern liberals and Southern conservatives had yet to fragment over civil rights and fiscal policy. Legend has it that Lyndon Johnson declared of the Democratic Party when signing the Civil Rights Act, "We have lost the South for a generation." If he said it, he was prophetic. Southern Democratic senators led by Richard B. Russell of Georgia felt betrayed by their leader from Texas. The Democrat senatorial representation from the states of the Deep South declined from 17 of 18 in 1964 to 4 of 18 in the Congress elected in 2004. The Democrat share in the House declined commensurately. With the movement of Northern industry to the South, a trend that began after World War II, the lock the Democrats had on Southern politics was bound to change. There is little doubt, however, that the Civil Rights Act accelerated the process. I am saddened that from a Republican perspective, a good outcome was achieved for the wrong reasons. The four congressional caucuses, two in each body, have shifted dramatically over the years. Each caucus, two Republican, two Democratic, used to comprise liberals, moderates, and conservatives. To be sure, the proportions differed by party, but there was rarely enough cohesion to produce overwhelming majorities for any piece of legislation in any of the four caucuses. Votes on legislation typically would be Democrats 60% for, 40% against, and Republicans 40% for, 60% against, or vice versa. Today's congressional caucuses, reflecting the reorientation of party affiliations in the South, have become either predominantly liberal, the Democrats, or conservative, the Republicans. Accordingly, legislation that used to split party votes 60% to 40% is now more likely to be 95% to 5%. Legislation has consequently become highly partisan. One could argue that over our long history, there's never been any love lost between liberals and conservatives. But people did not run under the banner of a conservative party or a liberal party. The mechanisms of governing, committee assignments and leadership posts, were Democratic or Republican, and party power held sway. The eventual dominance of Republicans in Southern state politics brought the two major parties to numerical parity, but, in the process, induced an ideological divide between conservative Republicans and liberal Democrats. It has left a vast, untended center from which a viable, well-financed, independent presidential candidate could conceivably emerge in 2008, or if not then, in 2012. The political chasm has gone beyond the titillation of political pundits. Governance has become dangerously dysfunctional. The media and the large crowds paying extraordinary tribute to Gerald Ford were also mourning the demise of collegial politics. Americans had voted the Republicans out of congressional leadership less than 2 months earlier. I don't think the Democrats won. It was the Republicans who lost. The Democrats came to power in the Congress because they were the only party left standing. I often wonder if a ticket of a Republican for president and a Democrat for vice president, or the reverse, would attract the vast untended center. Perhaps this issue wouldn't matter if the world were at peace. With the increasing prominence of the invisible hand of globalization effectively overseeing the billions of daily economic decisions, who the leaders are would be less important. But that has not been the case since 9/11. Who holds the reins of government matters. Chapter 12. The Universals of Economic Growth. As chairman of the Fed, I often found that dealing with the urgent issues confronting U.S. economic policy required exploring the many ways human nature and market forces interact. I've told the story in the preceding chapters of how I came to understand the workings of the economic world, a 60-year learning process. In the chapters that follow, I will set forth some of the conclusions I've reached. I'll try to convey my understanding of the forces that bind together the world economy and drive its evolution, as well as the forces that threaten to pull it apart. I identified early in my professional career competition as the primary driver of economic growth and standards of living in the United States. In moving to a global context decades later, I was required to alter my perspective very little. When I was nominated in 1987 by President Reagan to chair the Federal Reserve Board, numerous commentators expressed concern about my lack of international economic experience, for good reason. In running the domestically oriented Townsend Greenspan, I had little exposure to the international economy, aside from the economics of international oil. My stint at the Council of Economic Advisers in the mid-1970s did expose me to the successes and travails of Europe, and to some extent those of emerging Asia. But it was not until I arrived at the Federal Reserve in August 1987 that I immersed myself in the details of the rest of the world and the forces that drove it. Latin America's periodic crises during the 1980s and 1990s, the collapse of the Soviet Union and its economy, Mexico's near default in 1995, and the scary financial crises that spread across emerging markets, culminating in Russia's default in 1998, dramatically rearranged my priorities and focus. My first tutor at the Federal Reserve was the head of its Division of International Finance, Ted Truman. A distant relative of President Harry Truman, he had earned a Ph.D. from Yale, where he taught for several years before joining the Fed staff. I absorbed a great deal from Ted, but after a long, distinguished Federal Reserve career, in 1998, Truman was appointed Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for International Affairs. His replacement, Karen Johnson, with a doctorate from MIT, continued my education. During my Fed years, I interacted with experts on virtually every international economic issue imaginable, from the opaque budget accounting rules governing our financial contributions to the IMF to the economics of China's Pearl River Delta. I also had to continually recalibrate my views of how the U.S. economy worked in the context of ever-expanding globalization. Overseeing my schooling on the U.S. economy, in addition to Don Cohn, was David Stockton, the Fed's chief economist since 2000 and a Fed staffer since 1981. He never sought nor received the press that Fed governors get, but when the governors gave speeches, it was his forecast of the U.S. economy that Fed watchers were getting. We governors learned to see him as the indispensable, behind-the-scenes staffer. David is so low-key that it wasn't until after we'd worked together closely for years that I learned that his distant forebear, Richard Stockton, was a signer of the Declaration of Independence. Long before Adam Smith wrote his 1776 masterpiece, An Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations, people were arguing over the shortest, straightest path to prosperity. Truly, it is an argument without end. But even so, the data point to three important characteristics influencing global growth. 1. The extent of competition domestically, and, especially for developing nations, the extent of a country's openness to trade and its integration with the rest of the world. 2. The quality of a country's institutions that make an economy work. And 3. The success of its policymakers in implementing the measures necessary for macroeconomic stability. But while there appears to be a general consensus that these three conditions are essential to prosperity, I suspect that if economic development experts were polled, many would offer them in different orders of importance and probably also highlight different aspects of each one. My experience leads me to consider state-enforced property rights as the key growth-enhancing institution. For if those rights were not enforced, open trade and the huge benefits of competition and comparative advantage would be seriously and dramatically impeded. People generally do not exert the effort to accumulate the capital necessary for economic growth unless they can own it. Ownership, of course, can be quite conditional. Do I own a parcel of land outright? Or are there so many easements that it is of very little value to me? Or, most important, if governments at their discretion can seize my property, how valuable are my property rights? Under constant fear of expropriation, what effort will I put forward to improve my property? And what price can I set for it if I choose to sell it? It has been startling to see over the years what even a little private ownership will do. When China granted highly diluted rights of ownership to the rural residents who tilled vast community-owned agricultural plots, yield per acre and rural standards of living rose measurably. It was an unrelentingly embarrassing stain on the Soviet Union's central planning that a very substantial percentage of its crops came from privately owned plots that covered only a small fraction of tilled land. As living requires physical property, food, clothing, homes, people need the legal protection to own and dispose of such property without the threat of arbitrary confiscation by the state or mobs in the street. To be sure, people have to and do survive in totalitarian societies, but theirs is a lesser existence. John Locke, the 17th-century British philosopher, whose contributions to the Enlightenment evoked a set of principles that profoundly influenced the notions of the founding fathers of the United States, wrote in 1690 that man hath by nature a power to preserve his life, liberty, and estate against the injuries and attempts of other men. Locke's assertion in his second treatise of civil government is worth citing in full. Man being born, as has been proved, with a title to perfect freedom and an uncontrolled enjoyment of all the rights and privileges of the law of nature, equally with any other man or number of men in the world, hath by nature a power not only to preserve his property, that is, his life, liberty, and estate, against the injuries and attempts of other men, but to judge of and punish the breaches of that law in others, as he is persuaded the offense deserves, even with death itself, in crimes where the heinousness of the fact, in his opinion, requires it. Chapter 7, Section 87. Regrettably, the notion of rights to capital and other income-earning assets remains conflicted, especially in societies that still believe that profit-seeking is not quite moral. A key purpose of property rights, after all, is to protect assets in order to use them to profit. Such rights are not supportable in a society that holds any significant remnant of the Marxist view of property as theft. That notion rests on the presumption that wealth created under a division of labor is produced jointly and hence is owned collectively. Any rights inhering in an individual therefore must be stolen from society as a whole. Such a view, of course, predates Marx and has deep roots in many religions. The presumption of individual property ownership and the legality of its transfer must be deeply embedded in the culture of a society for free market economies to function effectively. In the West, the moral validity of property rights is accepted, or at least acquiesced in, by virtually the whole of the population. Attitudes toward property ownership are passed from one generation to the next through family values and education. These attitudes derive from the deepest values governing social interaction that people hold. Hence, the transition from the so-called collective rights of socialist economies to the individual property rights of market economies can be expected to be slow. Altering what a nation teaches its children is difficult and cannot be accomplished overnight. Clearly, not all democracies protect the private right of property with the same fervor. Indeed, they vary widely. India, the largest democracy in the world, has so much regulation of business activity that it significantly weakens the right to freely use and dispose of individual property, an essential measure of the degree of property rights protection. Nor is it the case that all societies with firmly protected property rights bend invariably to the majority will of the populace on all public issues. Certainly in its earlier years, Hong Kong did not have a democratic process, but a list of rights protected by British common law. Singapore, from a similar heritage, protects property and contract rights, the crucial pillars of market efficiency, but lacks other characteristics of Western democracies with which we are familiar. Nonetheless, democracies with a free press and protection of minority rights are the most effective form of government that safeguards property rights, largely because such democracies rarely allow discontent to rise to a point that leads to explosive changes in economic regimes. Authoritarian capitalism, on the other hand, is inherently unstable because it forces aggrieved citizens to seek redress outside the law. That risk is capitalized in higher financing costs. While the debate over property rights and democracy will doubtless persist, I was taken with an observation made by Amartya Sen, the Nobel Prize winner in economics. In the terrible history of famines in the world, no substantial famine has ever occurred in any independent and democratic country with a relatively free press. We cannot find exceptions to this rule, no matter where we look. With the media in authoritarian regimes tending toward self-censorship, market interventionist policies, the most prevalent cause of disrupted distribution of food, go unreported and uncorrected until too late. The importance of property rights is a larger issue than that of creating incentives to invest by established business or even incentives for investors tinkering in a garage. Hernando de Soto, the Peruvian economist, came to the Federal Reserve in January 2003 to brief me on a seemingly radical idea to elevate the standard of living of a significant segment of the world's impoverished. One of the aspects of my job was meeting with foreign visitors who passed through my office when they were in town. These opportunities were a valuable source of information for me and the Fed staff members who often sat in on the meetings. De Soto's reputation, at least as best I could judge it, was of a well-intentioned but misguided idealist, or somewhat less flatteringly, a Don Quixote attacking windmills. His simple notion was that most poverty-stricken squatters had effective use of property, homes or land, but suffered from the lack of legal title that would enable them to sell the property for cash or use it as collateral for a loan from a bank or other financial institution. If a clear legal title to the property could be established, large amounts of wealth would be unlocked. I thought it a novel idea worth considering. Certainly, other theories of development had little to show for themselves, despite the vast sums of official foreign aid spent on them since World War II. In any event, I was sufficiently intrigued to meet with De Soto. His calculations suggested untapped property values exceeding $9 trillion worldwide. If even remotely accurate, it would be a notable addition to the value of legally protected property. He had been meeting with politicians in many developing countries to try to bring legal clarity to much of the poverty-stricken world's de facto land ownership. De Soto was optimistic, but I did not believe he was likely to make as much progress as he hoped. After he departed, I wondered, is it possible that he is onto something that we have somehow missed? It was evident to me that he would have difficulty convincing often corrupt politicians to cede the rights to what amounted to de facto, if not de jure, state property. There were two seemingly insurmountable barriers to De Soto's goals. First, a significant number of developing world politicians believe in some form of collective ownership, even if they shy away from the notion that property is theft. Perhaps more relevant, granting legal authority to sell or collateralize squatters' land would empower a significant segment of a society, with a comparable dilution of politicians' power. Legalization would remove the latent power to confiscate at will large segments of squatters' land. However, recent incidents in China suggest how politically destabilizing that can be. In the endeavor to modernize, many provincial and local Chinese authorities, in their version of creative destruction, periodically confiscate peasants' land for development. Riots have been widespread. Granting clear legal ownership rights to peasants for the land they till would go a very long way toward putting an end to such discontent. Recognition of property rights by China's National Congress of the People in March 2007 shied away from granting unequivocal rights to rural land. Though the means to get there may not be altogether clear, Hernando de Soto's goal is a very appealing one. Protection of property has always been a moving target as the law continually tries to keep up with the nature of economic change. Even in the United States, where property rights are broadly protected, the claims of property owners in New London, Connecticut, whose land was taken over by city government in 2005 for commercial redevelopment, were brought to the U.S. Supreme Court. The court's ruling in favor of city government provoked loud outcries in the Congress. So it's not surprising that different cultures have different views as to whether and to what extent property should be protected. This issue is becoming pronounced as property is becoming increasingly intellectual. I explore that thicket in Chapter 25. While the rule of law and property rights appear to me to be the most prominent institutional pillars of economic growth and prosperity, other factors are also clearly essential. Historically, societies that seek high levels of instant gratification and are willing to borrow against future incomes to achieve it have more often than not suffered inflation and stagnation. The economies of such societies tend to run larger government budget deficits financed with fiat money from a printing press. Eventually, the ensuing inflation leads to recession, or worse, often because central banks are forced to clamp down. Then the process starts all over again. Many countries in Latin America have been particularly prone to this populist malady, as I discuss in Chapter 17. I regret that the United States may not be wholly immune to it. A rarely discussed but important macroeconomic determinant of economic success is the extent of an economy's flexibility, and hence its resilience to shocks. The bounce back of the U.S. economy following 9/11 is testament to the importance of flexibility, as I've pointed out. Moreover, flexibility and the extent of property rights are related. To obtain flexibility, the competitive marketplace must be free to adjust, which means market participants must be free to allocate property as they see fit. Restrictions on pricing, borrowing, affiliations, and market practice more generally have slowed growth. Its obverse, deregulation, is increasingly associated with reform. As recently as the 1960s, reform was associated with regulation of business. Ideas govern policy. Another important requirement for the proper functioning of market capitalism is also not often, if ever, covered in lists of factors contributing to economic growth and standards of living. Trust in the word of others. Where the rule of law prevails, despite everyone's right to legal redress of a perceived grievance, if there is more than a small fraction of outstanding contracts that require adjudication, court systems would be overwhelmed, as would society's ability to be governed by the rule of law. This implies that in a free society governed by the rights and responsibilities of its citizens, the vast majority of transactions must be voluntary, which of necessity presupposes trust in the word of those with whom we do business, in almost all cases, strangers. It is remarkable that, as I noted in an earlier chapter, large numbers of contracts, especially in financial markets, are initially oral, confirmed by a written document only at a later time, even after much price movement. It is remarkable how much trust we have in the pharmacist who fills the prescription ordered by our physician, or the trust we grant to automakers that their motor vehicles will run as certified. We are not fools. We bank on the self-interest of our counterparties in trade. Just contemplate how little business would get done if that were not the prevailing culture in which we lived. The division of labor so essential to our standard of living would not exist. As I noted earlier, material well-being, that is, wealth creation, requires people to take risks. We can't be sure our actions to acquire food, clothing, and shelter, for example, will succeed. But the greater our trust in the people with whom we trade, the greater the accumulation of wealth. In a market system based on trust, reputation will have a significant economic value. Reputation, capitalized formally as goodwill on business balance sheets or otherwise, is an important contributor to the market value of a company. Reputation and the trust it fosters have always appeared to me to be the core required attributes of market capitalism. Laws, at best, can prescribe only a small fraction of the day-by-day activities in the marketplace. When trust is lost, a nation's ability to transact business is palpably undermined. In the marketplace, uncertainties created by not always truthful counterparties raise credit risk and thereby increase real interest rates. As a bank regulator for more than 18 years, I came to recognize that government regulation cannot substitute for individual integrity. In fact, any form of government guarantees of credit lessens the need of financial counterparties to earn a reputation for honest dealings. It is conceivable, of course, that government guarantees are superior to an individual's reputation. But guarantees, even the most widely praised, such as deposit insurance, have costly consequences. I concluded, and I suspect most regulators agree, that the first and most effective line of defense against fraud and insolvency is counterparties' surveillance. For example, J.P. Morgan thoroughly scrutinizes the balance sheet of Merrill Lynch before it lends. It does not look to the Securities and Exchange Commission to verify Merrill's solvency. While banking and medicine may be the most visible exemplars of the market value of reputation, it is pervasive throughout all professions. When I was a child, jokes about the scruples of used car salesmen were widespread. But in truth, a flagrantly unscrupulous used car salesman is one who will be out of business before long. These days, almost every professional field is constrained by some regulatory framework, so it's harder than it once was to isolate the reputation effect. But a sector in which one can is e-commerce. Alibris, for example, is a website that acts as a broker between sellers and buyers of used books. If you were eager to buy an early edition of Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations, you might search on Alibris for the names of booksellers around the country who had copies for sale. Customers are given the opportunity to rate the reliability of booksellers from whom they've purchased at least one book, and those ratings no doubt play an important role in the decision as to which of several booksellers to use. This form of public feedback is a powerful incentive to booksellers to be honest about the condition of their wares and to fulfill orders fully and promptly. But no one is immune to customer skepticism. As Fed chairman, I was queried by fellow central bankers with large holdings of U.S. dollars about whether dollars were safe investments. More surprising than any list of key factors for growth and improved standards of living is what would not be on such a list. How is it possible that a superabundance of natural resources, oil, gas, copper, iron ore, would not significantly add to a nation's production and wealth? Paradoxically, most analysts conclude that, particularly in developing countries, natural resource bonanzas tend to reduce rather than enhance living standards. The danger takes the form of an economic affliction nicknamed Dutch disease. The Economist coined the term in the 1970s to describe the travails of manufacturers in the Netherlands after the discovery there of natural gas. Dutch disease strikes when foreign demand for an export drives up the exchange value of the exporting country's currency. This increase in the currency's value makes the nation's other export products less competitive. Analysts often cite this pattern as a reason why relatively resource-poor Hong Kong, Japan, and Western Europe have thrived, while oil-rich Nigeria and others have not. In the Dutch case, heavy foreign demand for the gas led to large purchases of guilders, which drove up the value of the Dutch currency relative to the dollar, the Deutschmark, and all other major currencies. This meant that Dutch exports of anything other than natural gas were put at a competitive disadvantage in world markets. Producers of export goods paid wages and other costs in guilders, which, with their higher foreign exchange value, meant higher costs denominated in dollars and other currencies. To sell competitively in foreign markets, Dutch non-gas exporters would receive fewer guilders for their wares and would have to live with lower profit margins, or, more likely, raise prices in dollars and sell less. The condition became known as the Dutch disease, even though the Netherlands handled the problem without major disruption. 10 years from now, 20 years from now, you will see. Oil will bring us ruin. is how former Venezuelan oil minister and OPEC co-founder Juan Pablo Perez Alfonso put it in the 1970s. He correctly foresaw the inability of virtually all OPEC nations to use their riches to diversify significantly beyond petroleum and related products. Besides distorting the value of the currency, natural resource wealth often has crippling social effects. Easy unearned wealth tends to dampen productivity, it turns out. Some Gulf oil states have extended so many amenities to their citizens that those without an inbred will to work don't. Mundane tasks fall to immigrants and guest workers who gladly collect what is to them a good wage. There are political effects, too. A ruling clique can use part of the resource revenue to placate the population and keep people from marching against the regime. No wonder tiny São Tomé and Príncipe off the west coast of Africa, upon the discovery in its territorial waters of significant reservoirs of crude oil, had a mixed reaction about exploiting them. President Fradique de Menezes remarked in 2003, "I have promised my people that we will avoid what some call the Dutch disease, or the crude awakening, or the curse of oil." Statistics show that resource-rich developing countries perform markedly worse in terms of GDP development than resource-poor countries. Their social indicators are also below average. In São Tomé and Príncipe, we are determined to avoid this paradox of plenty. Dutch disease primarily afflicts developing countries because they are ill-prepared to fend it off. At the same time, the scale of the challenge tends to be greater. Since nature distributes its treasures without regard to the size or sophistication of national economies, resource bonanzas are more apt to dwarf the GDP of a developing country than that of a developed one. In general, it appears that if a country is developed before the discovery of a natural resource bonanza, it is immune to any long-lasting pernicious effect. Nevertheless, Dutch disease can strike anywhere. Great Britain went through an apparent bout of it in the early 1980s, following the development of North